From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, We Don't Die. It's an amazing story, a skeptic who's now a believer. Here's what's happening. Scientists have found that a mutation in a new strain of bird flu infecting people in China can render it resistant to a key first-line treatment drug without limiting its ability to spread in mammals. The discovery means that unlike seasonal flu strains, which often become less transmittable when they develop resistance to drugs like Tamiflu, the new H7N9 bird flu does not lose any of its spreading potential with drug resistance. Well, as we've been talking about for some time, researchers now from the University of Colorado Boulder recently completed analyzing data from a coronal mass ejection that took place in the summer of 2012. The CME, which was reportedly the most powerful electrical discharge ever recorded from the sun, narrowly missed the planet. Now, it was not Earth-directed, meaning that the electromagnetic mass was ejected by the sun when it was facing away from the planet. However, had it occurred just a week prior, the highly charged particles would have struck Earth, and it could have been a disaster around the globe, a disaster. And as we've been saying for some time, it's going to be just a matter of when, not if. William Forstchen, of course, the noted author of One Second After, with us. William, this situation is going to happen sooner than later, I'm afraid.
George, you're absolutely right. The 2012 event, the coronal mass ejection, crossed what is the orbital plane of the Earth. And you hit it dead on, that if a week earlier when the sun and its rotation had been pointed straight at us, you and I would not be talking this evening. We'd be back 500 years because the entire infrastructure of this planet would have been blown down by it.
You know, with this kind of a situation, with our grid not insulated, something that you and I have been talking about for some time now, what are we going to do? Because, you know, as we both agree, it's going to happen, but, you know, governments aren't going to be prepared.
Georgia, the key thing is we have to work from the bottom up. We individually have to be prepared and then work with our neighbors and our community. And several states now are finally starting to make some movement, my home state here of North Carolina being one of them. I have zero trust that the federal government is ever going to do anything about this or anything effective over the next, at least during the current administration.
Our William's book, of course, One Second After, keep an eye on that. William, thank you so much. Well, problems aboard the International Space Station, astronauts aboard, they are safe, but one of two cooling units has broken, and NASA's trying to figure out how to get the thing fixed. The asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs may have sent life to Mars and the moons of Jupiter, according to U.S. researchers. They calculated how many Earth rocks big enough to shelter life were ejected by the asteroids in the last 3.5 billion years. The impact was strong enough to fire chunks of debris all the way to Europa, that they write. Thousands of potentially life-bearing rocks also made it to Mars, which may have once been habitable, they add. Microsoft has said it has sold more than 2 million Xbox One consoles since the new video game system launched on November 22nd. People are going crazy. Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our techie. Why are they buying all these boxes, Lauren?
Well, it's kind of an interesting situation because you would think that 2 million sales since November 22nd would be something for the industry to really get excited about. But in reality, analysts are actually kind of down on the Xbox, on Microsoft's Xbox, because it costs $500. And Sony's PS4 costs $100 less. So the thinking is that after the holiday season, Sony is going to really clean up, because the $100 difference is going to, these consoles are turning into commodity items, because more and more of the new games that are coming out are going to be cross-platform, which means you could just as well run it on a $400 box as a $500 box. So unless hundreds of millions of new consoles are going to be sold, and analysts don't think that's going to happen anytime soon because it is really a maturing marketplace, it's going to be a very cost-conscious decision. So Microsoft, you'll recall, Microsoft took a lot of flack early on this because at first they were saying you couldn't use it unless you were online all the time. There was a big blow-up over that, and they reversed. Then there was concerns over whether you could run used games. They kind of reversed on that. So I think what's going to happen is people are probably going to go for the cheaper unit. And because Microsoft has really not wanted to unbundle some of their higher-end features like Kinect, the motion control thing, Sony is expected to really clean up. And that's not going to be good news for Microsoft, despite these enormous sales in this short period of time.
Now, the software, the games, are they selling like hotcakes?
Yeah, the games sell, but you know they're a niche market, right? I mean, not everybody wants every kind of game, and the games are not cheap anymore. So this is why this whole issue of whether or not you can exchange and play used games is very important to the people that are involved in gaming, because they don't want to make these purchases and then be in a situation where they can't sell them or trade them later on.
All right, Lauren, thanks so much. In Florida, the search is on for a stolen truck. What did they get? About $120,000 worth of Hershey's chocolate. Well, in a moment, we're going to be talking about this push for a global government. We're going live to Ian Wishart in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Ian Wishart is an investigative journalist, a network television reporter, news director, and former number one rated national talk show host in New Zealand and very sought after international talk show guest on the subjects of the push for global government. His latest work is Totalitaria. What if the enemy is the state? Ian, welcome to Coast. How are you, sir?
Good evening, George. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Tell me, how did you get involved way down in New Zealand from where we are in investigating global government?
Well, New Zealand's a bit of a lab rat, the canary in the mineshaft for global government. We're several years ahead of where the US is, not for any particular reason except that New Zealand is a country with a range of landscapes and a small population of 5 million people. So things that are tested out internationally are tested first in New Zealand, systems and technology and that sort of thing, because it's easy to do. So we get to see some of the social engineering first and then see it roll out across the world, and that's what we're seeing with the whole global government picture, really.
Now, you're an editor of what is called Investigate Magazine and the author, of course, of the book I just mentioned, Totalitaria. Tell me a little bit more about your background.
Yeah, well, I've been a journalist for over three decades, worked in network radio and television, hosted a talk show here in New Zealand nationally at night, And been involved for the last 10 years or so in editing Investigate magazine. And we sort of break the sort of stories that the mainstream media find too difficult or don't have the time or resource, or it's above their pay grade sort of thing. So my work has very much taken me at various times to the sort of stories that, you get information on international tax haven movements, you get information on international espionage. We solve murder cases, that sort of thing. There's some fascinating stories across our paths, but this world government push is certainly the one that takes the cake.
And this push has been going on for how long?
In the book Totalitaria, what I've done is I've taken it right back to, I've given a history of the world, if you like, in a nutshell, and said that effectively humankind has always had a lust for power and control, but we've lacked the technology to really sort of make it happen at a global scale. I mean, if you look back at past empires like the Romans, the Mongols, that sort of thing, they were big, but they didn't really have the technology to govern in real time across the globe. The British Empire was the biggest. It covered at one stage 24% of the planet's surface. But in the last 60 years, the rise of modern technology and globalization and international communication has meant that increasingly we are seeing this trend towards global control. And as we've seen with the revelations from Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks and so forth, you can flip a switch in Washington and be listening into a conversation in South Africa or New Zealand or Australia, no trouble at all. Information, it cuts both ways because, of course, there's a free information movement over the internet and through the media as well. So the public are much more informed than they were 30, 40 years ago. But nonetheless, the ability to control the world is now literally only a matter of years away.
Now, but by being able to deal with social networking and the internet, as you just mentioned, does that make it more difficult for those globalists to do what they want to do?
Yes and no. In the book, I devote a chapter to the origins of Facebook. I mean, that story is well known, but the reality is that you go back 25 odd years to the early 90s, and the Israeli Mossad developed a program called Promise, which back in those days was state-of-the-art and nowadays would be considered like a tin can and a piece of string. But the idea of Promise was it was Trojan software that was incorporated in various government computer systems that would open a back door for the Israeli intelligence and later CIA to suck out all the contact information from various computer users that were using the government systems. And it might be electric power utilities or phone companies, that sort of thing. And what they were trying to do was build up a database on networks of people, who people were contacting, who they were in touch with, so they could, you know, build up intelligence about the population overall. Now, when Facebook came along, Mark Zuckerberg effectively walked right into their hands, because here was a technology and a social media thing. This is what I say in the book. You know, people will eventually beg for this sort of stuff. Facebook was so appealing that rather than having to force surveillance on the world population allowed the surveillance to occur. And Facebook is being used, as we've now discovered, and certainly as I've written in the book, to monitor people on a global scale, and not just Facebook, Twitter, the other social networks. All of our communication traffic is now being analyzed. So although information flow is more open today than it was, by the same token, the powers that be are now looking at that information. And what I'm saying in the Totalitarian book is, you know, we might be okay with some of the surveillance today. Let's just say play devil's advocate on this. We might be fine with the idea that we're hunting international global terrorists, in quote marks. You know, I've got nothing to hide, I've got nothing to fear. But the reality is, and I make this point clearly in the book, when we open the door to this Trojan horse, there's no shutting the gate afterwards. That technology is there for keeps, barring a revolution. And that means that, you know, while we might agree with the purposes it's being used for today, who knows what regime will be in power 15 years from now and what purpose they will turn that technology to. And all of a sudden, and I this is why I've written the book very clearly, because I've mapped out where the world is going. And the people behind the push for world government want to control ordinary people like you and I. They want to control what we think. They want to control what we say. They want to control where we live. And so if you become a dissident, if you start to dissent from that 15, 20 years from now, the technology being used to hunt Islamic terrorists today will be used to isolate you tomorrow.
You're right on, Ian. I mean, that is exactly what they're planning to do, and that's their method and their modus operandi. And you're right. You know, these administrations of today may be very harmless and innocent, but we don't know who's going to be in power down the line. But here's my big question for you. The globalists who understand the plan and they're years ahead of themselves, how do we know they haven't concocted, as some people believe, terrorism and things like that in order to get these controls today by having us simply say, please take care of us, protect us, do what you need to do?
When you read Totalitarian, that's exactly what you're going to discover. I worked, one of my jobs in the past, I worked as a media press secretary for the number three ranked cabinet minister in New Zealand at the time, back in the 1980s. Now, he went on to head the World Trade Organization, that particular gentleman. But I had a top secret diplomatic clearance, and I had access to all the international espionage cables that were floating, you know, back and forth between the US and New Zealand and Britain and so forth. And so I got to see how the government works at an inside level. And I got to see the manipulation that was going on and the crises that were manufactured to distract the public from other things that the politicians would rather you didn't know about and the bureaucrats would rather that you didn't know about. And so I became, A, very aware, and B, very cynical about the whole system. And that, I guess, is one reason why I started to become more of an investigative journalist and start looking behind the obvious headlines and look for the real story. You know, when you're a journalist as well, when you're trained up as a journalist, one of the oldest things you're taught, follow the money. Who benefits?
That's right.
And if you do that every time, you'll always come up with the answer.
Well, with Ian Wishart, of course, his book, Totalitaria, What If the Enemy is the State? Why don't they just leave us alone, Ian? I mean, sure, they want power and they want more money and they're unhappy with what they've got and they want more. Well, why don't they just leave us alone?
Well, here's where it gets really spooky, George. I'm an investigative journalist, hard-bitten sort of guy, have been for decades. But when I was researching this book, one of the things I came across was what I call a convergence of opportunities. And by that I mean that you have a target, a goal, which is the push for global government. But you have a number of groups that are involved in that push. And they're all coming from different angles. You've got the political globalists who want power and control. You've got corporate globalists who want to make a lot of money and be able to clip the ticket and transfer all their manufacturing to third world countries so that Americans and New Zealanders and Brits and so forth lose manufacturing jobs because it's cheaper to pay somebody 50 cents an hour in China or whatever.
That's right.
So their goal for world government is to maintain their corporate control. But then you have this other group who are, if you like, actually manipulating the entire thing. And that was the thing that stunned me when I researched Totalitaria. It is spooky. The book has gone viral in its release down in New Zealand and Australia. Because at the heart of this book is a group who wants spiritual power. And what that means is they're an obscure religious organization, an occult group.
Huh.
And back in the 1870s, the leader of that particular group received what she believed was a warning from a 2,000-year-old spirit entity who told her that, you know, the time was coming when the Absolute Supreme was going to come back and rule the world, and the human population had to be conditioned to become ready for that. And so an agenda developed from 1870 onwards that eventually infiltrated virtually every level of society, and certainly in the book, what you find is that the disciples of this particular organization went on to take on senior roles at the United Nations when it was created in 1945. And they used their positions as heads of UNESCO and the UN Development Program and so forth to bring their policies and their religious beliefs into developing policies for the entire world with the aim of raising planetary consciousness and bringing back the Absolute Supreme. So behind this whole global government push, you've got, it's like an onion, you've got a bunch of layers, and you have the people who are in it for the money, you have people who are in it for power, and the people who are in it because they think they can change the world and change what you and I believe.
On the face of it, does it sound like globalism is nice and works and is going to be helpful to the entire planet?
That's exactly the way it's being sold. And one of the things I said in the book is that, you know, they say turkeys won't vote for an early Christmas. In reality, the evidence that I've seen suggests they very much will, because it's being painted, and you made the point earlier, a very good point, about these crises that pop up. We're being made to feel less and less secure in our own homes, in our own jobs. We want the government increasingly to take care of us. Now, this gets back to my point about New Zealand being a test case, a dummy run for the United States. Because New Zealand's a small economy, we've been, if you like, adopting soft democratic socialism for the last 50-odd years. And we are very much in line with the United Nations programs for what they want to roll out. Now, that's starting to come into America now. And it's this whole global citizen, we're part of the larger whole. And on the face of it, that's true. We are part of the whole planet, and we do have to get along. But hidden behind this mask of friendliness and peace and warmth and love is a very, very dark agenda. And that's what people are discovering at the heart of the Totalitaria book, because it's laid out chapter and verse. It really is staggering.
Well, it's amazing that you have been able to work on this, Ian. Do you ever look over your shoulder?
Look, in my first book that I wrote, I ended up being sacked from the major TV network that I worked for. It was called The Paradise Conspiracy back in the 90s, and I'd discovered international tax haven transactions that were funding Iraq during the Gulf War and what have you, and a whole lot of strange dealings were going on, billions of dollars worth of tax haven deals.
Yeah, you've got to be careful. Ian, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back, talk about George Orwell's 1984, which we both agree came a little too early. We'll be back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Ian Wishart with us, of course, his book, Totalitaria. Ian, you talk about George Orwell, who I was fascinated with his book, 1984. And when we were looking at it, we were teenagers, and it seemed like 1984, it was years and years away, and now it's years and years behind us. He was ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Yeah, George Orwell was ahead of his time by some, I think 2014 is probably a good bet as to how you could more realistically put it, because everything's now in place, and even the social conditions are in place, the will of the people to welcome Big Brother, which was one of Orwell's points. Big Brother would eventually be loved. That's taking place. This whole movement is insidious, and it's a bit, I compare it to The Matrix, the movie The Matrix. You know, I think we're at a stage where people either need to wake up or they need to keep sleeping. I'm one of those people who wants to wake up and see what's coming down the road towards us, and that's why I've written the book.
Is it a good thing that we're aware of this and that people might be able to fight back in some form or fashion?
Yeah, it's a good thing that we're aware of it. I think, you know, otherwise the deception continues and gains speed. One of the ways to fight back at this level has to be grassroots. It has to be viral. People have to talk about it, tell their friends about it. One of the things people are doing with the book, for example, in New Zealand, is because this stuff is not covered in the mainstream media, and because I'm an investigative journalist and I've actually nailed down the stuff, this is not your average conspiracy theory book. There's about 500 footnotes and references and citations in this book, and I've nailed it down to the original source documents from the United Nations and elsewhere. So people who want to challenge me on this can go through the footnotes and see for themselves exactly what I'm saying, that it's true. And so this has been a major wake-up call down here in New Zealand and Australia, because people are reading the book and they're just, you know, their eyebrows are raising. They're saying, we've got to get this out to our friends. And they're buying, you know, 20 or 30 copies of this and giving them away, which is what I mean by viral. The information, it's important that we tell our friends and colleagues to balance up the propaganda that's being fed to us and to alert us to the deceptions that are being perpetrated on us. Because all of this is being done in the name of peace, light, and love. And these things, you know, no one wants to disagree with peace, light, and love. But behind it, as I said, there's a real trap. And that's the danger. If we don't become aware of what's behind us, we run the risk of being steamrolled by it.
Ian, is it a game for these people? Because as we mentioned, they've got more money than God. They've got the power they already want. They do what they want to do. They go where they want to go. They have their homes, planes, and yachts. Is this like a little chess game and we are the pieces? We're the pawns on the board?
Yeah, very much so. And in a spiritual sense, and this is what makes this book different, when you look at the agenda of the spiritual power, the group behind this, and what they want to change and what they want to impose, they're effectively wanting to set up a new world religion and to knock off the hard edges of all the other religions and sort of create this amalgam. And, of course, that seems like a really great idea on the face of it, because you think, oh, well, you know, that religion is too judgmental or whatever. We don't like that. We'll get rid of the hard bits. But the point about it is, when you read the agenda of what these people are trying to do and the religion that they're trying to create and the God that they want to worship, that's when you want to scratch your head and say, hang on, have I signed up for this? Is this what they promised me?
You know, when we talk, Ian, about they, right, we talk about the Illuminati, but in many references, it's always they are doing this. A lot of people will say, okay, who are they? And, you know, some of them, of course, are power brokers that we don't see, names we would probably know, but aren't some of them in elected official positions now? They've got the kind of power, and they're just like part of the group?
Absolutely. And in fact, people have often asked me, you know, how could America possibly be dragged into this? Because America is a free country and has a very strong tradition of freedom. Two things are going to happen. One is the people are being conditioned to accept all this and to think along these lines through the education policies now being introduced, through the social policies, and through exposure to these ideas on a global level. And secondly, because the way the UN system is going to be imposed It's going to be based on international treaties, and most Americans don't understand or haven't studied the issue of international treaties to any great extent. Now, if you look at the climate change debate, back in 2009 at Copenhagen, they were desperate to introduce a world treaty on climate change. But the interesting thing about that treaty was it contained a draft clause imposing a world government for the very first time. It actually used the phrase a global government. Now, that treaty, if America had signed up to it, it would be bound to it for eternity. Now, you can say, sure, America can rescind a treaty. But the reality is if the rest of the planet has not rescinded the treaty, then America becomes an isolated country. And all of a sudden it becomes subject to trade sanctions under the United Nations and so forth. And you can't export your goods, harder to travel, harder to do business overseas. It becomes tough. And after a while, the American economy is ground down because the weight of the world is against them because they signed a treaty once and they can't get out of it. The global government system is a federalist system. It will be run by the United Nations, but federated power will still flow through the national elected governments of the US, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, France, Germany, etc. But they'll effectively become like little town councils. They will have powers to govern their countries respectively, but within the limits set for them by the globalist agenda. And when the people protest, the people will protest about it. The politicians will say, but our hands are tied. We're governed by international treaties. We can't get out of them.
Absolutely. We will be like, affiliates of a major holding company.
Exactly.
And that, the major holding company will be this group, and these other countries, including the United States, will merely be a piece of the pie.
Yeah, and it is always thrown back to the will of the world. The nations have spoken. This is now our international parliament. We're subject to the same laws as everybody else. You're just going to have to man up and take your punishment. But of course, the global agenda includes, relocation of vast numbers of people. It includes wealth redistribution. It includes a range of things that, we can have debates about the worth of that, and there are some good things about that, you can talk about. But nonetheless, it needs to be done openly, honestly, and transparently, not brought in under cover of an insidious master plan.
Now, Ian, if they're going to pull the United States in on it, they've got to do something about our military might, because they cannot permit us to have the kind of arsenal we have and the kind of might we have. They're going to have to break that down. How are they going to do that?
Well, they're working on that now. The United Nations is already working on a program of disarmament worldwide. Various arms treaties are being negotiated. There is a clear policy put to the UN by a group called Socialist International, which represents left-wing political parties worldwide. And they've echoed what the UN Development Program has said, and that is that they want member states like the United States, Britain, Australia, etc., to progressively disarm themselves and put the money they save from reducing their defense capabilities towards extra donations to the UN. And the UN will take a greater role in military peacemaking and peace keeping and so forth. So the UN becomes the world police authority and has the budget to do it. And one of the things with these treaties that they're trying to do is they're trying to get budgets, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars a year extra to the UN to fund all of this. And once the treaty switch is flicked, and it's being done, and for example, I come back again to climate change, once the treaty switch is flicked under the guise of protecting the planet from climate problems, it's flicked and you can't unflick it ever.
What will happen?
Starts to flow, and everything starts to flow from that. The power structures are in place. So that's why people need to wake up and become. That's why I've written the book.
What will happen to war worldwide?
It will increasingly become insurgency. And what you're seeing already is a trend towards that. The UN will increasingly take responsibility for a global response to various conflicts. The problem with the UN becoming a global police officer, and the problem with any one world government becoming a global police officer, is that no one can possibly ever stand against it. Not even the United States, with all of its military might, could stand up against the entire planet. And the UN, if it says, well, you've signed a treaty, and we've got the rest of the countries in the world to back us on this, it's not going to be pretty.
Will we have, Ian, the appearance of living the way we're living now, feeling free?
Absolutely, and you will. And the way that you're being, the way kids are being educated in New Zealand and Australia and the UK, and now in America through the Common Core program, I talk about this in the book as well. The UN had an agenda, going back to this occult group, And they recognized back in the late 1940s that the only way they could change the world was to get to the children. And so they put in place through UNESCO, change in the world education curriculum. And they've been implementing that over the past 5 decades across the world, designed specifically to increase allegiance to the United Nations as a superior global organization, mm-hmm. To recognize the major goals that the UN wants solved. And increasingly to no longer see themselves as citizens of a nation like America, but as citizens of the world. And that's a really important psychological shift. So the next generation coming in, you know, you and I were educated differently, but the next generation coming through the schools now are being very heavily educated to this level, certainly outside America, and the Common Core program is looking at bringing that into American schools as well. So this is part of the conditioning that I talk about in Totalitaria. You know, once they've captured the children, and they get to vote in 10 years' time, all bets are off.
How will they handle civil unrest in various countries?
They'll handle it very easily, simply by bringing in UN forces and maintaining control the same way that the UN starts. The UN's inefficient at the moment, but it's being tasked with a much more rapid response. And when more countries have signed up to this, as they are increasingly doing, and when more resources go the UN's way, as they will eventually do, the UN will be in a position to effectively hold power. But as I said, this comes back to the next issue. As Lord Acton said a long time ago, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Absolutely.
And right. This is the problem. When you hand over your powers to a world government, no one can stand against it. No one. At the moment, there's a balance of power in the world. The United States is balanced by the other countries, and the other countries are balanced by the USA, and so forth. There is a, and it's served our world well, having the US be the leader of the free world for the last 50, 60 years. But that what, time is changing, and the people behind us want it to change pretty fast.
What will happen to talk shows and talk show hosts like me, Alex Jones, like you, when they do this, when they implement this, and
two
we
things
continue,
will happen. One of which is that increasingly laws will be introduced describing the sort of any dissent effectively as hate speech, and because the education system is gearing towards conditioning people to accept the new regime unquestioningly, the people coming through will see what you are doing as dissent and wrong-headed and all the rest of it. And so that's at one level. The second level is that increasingly, you know, we'll become outcasts. And they may not even have to rely on force. They might just rely on marginalization because they already have control of the way people think.
But they could try to arrest us, right?
Yeah, they could. Well, if you look at Mark Stein in Canada and the hassles he's had with free speech issues, there is a very real risk, and this is the problem with the way the world is going. You are no longer being allowed to think the way that you want to think, necessarily. You are required to think and make public statements along the lines of what the authorities would like you to say. But they're too clever to just, you know, draft a law against it at this stage. What they do is they make you marginalized and make you seem out there, fringe, all the rest of it. And this is what I said, you know, the people effectively are being conditioned to beg for one world government regime. They will see it as the loving big brother of George Orwell's 1984, the iron fist and the velvet glove.
Who's going to win, the globalists or us?
I think that depends very much on how people wake up and what they let their politicians get away with. For America, the saving grace will be if enough people can become rapidly educated on the issues that I'm raising in Totalitaria, especially about international treaties and their power and the like,
some of these treaties, Ian, let me just jump in real quickly. Some of these treaties are done, and most people aren't even aware of them.
That's absolutely right.
Like bills get passed, people even the legislators don't read the bills.
Yeah.
I mean, so the populace, they don't read it. So these things are going to get done without us even knowing about it.
Yeah, they are. But you will find that with the big issues, the big treaties will be publicized. We had a win at Copenhagen in 2009 because we got hold of the draft treaty for the climate change proposals and found the phrase that would have instituted a world government at that stage. The United Nations is gearing up. Its next big announcement is 2015. It's going to release what it calls our planetary sustainability goals. And they are going to be effectively trying to set up the infrastructure to lead into a world government organisation under the guise of, again, dealing with planet environmental problems. If they wrap you up in enough red tape, then they have to bring in the bureaucrats. Once the bureaucracy's in place worldwide, then everything else flows from that. But my reason for writing the book is to raise all of these issues and say to people, look, here's the hard evidence, here's the UN documents, here's their agenda laid out bare. This is the join the dots. This is the book where all the conspiracy theory rumors become crystallized hard facts with quotes and citations you can go to and see for yourself. You know, this is power in the hands of ordinary people because they can then get onto your show, onto other shows, start talking about it, talk to their neighbors and friends. They can start rattling the cages of their senator, their Congress representative, and say, look, when we get a sign that this is going to happen, we don't want a bar of this. Anything that signs away America's sovereignty, anything that is ratified by Congress that signs away our sovereignty under an international treaty, we want to look at really, really carefully. We don't want to just go along with the flow because everyone's singing Kumbaya and talking about peace, love, and all the rest of it. We're not going to be fooled by that anymore. We agree with peace and love and the brotherhood of man, but we don't agree with it being used to hide a different agenda, which is what the issue is.
You know, one of the areas where I applaud joint ventures would be space.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems to work, but
yes.
Outside of that, I'm not a fan of any of the other things.
Each on its merits. I think, you know, that's the sensible thing about, you know, we're intelligent people as humans, and we can work out when things are good and when things are bad. The problem at the moment, and this comes back down to my time as a media press secretary, is I was involved in public manipulation campaigns and propaganda campaigns. I have seen them firsthand. I've seen them roll out. I've seen the tricks that the persuaders use to get people on board, you know, to get people emerging at rallies and protests and so forth. And everyone thinks they're doing a great thing, blah, 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 getting involved with the movement without realizing where the movement's leading them. It's a bit like the Pied Piper. And what I'm trying to do with Totalitaria is say, okay, you're hearing a tune, you like the tune, I want you to know who's actually playing the tune. And when you know who's playing the tune, then you can really decide whether you want to go along with it or whether you want to take each idea on its own merits and debate it properly and honestly and openly.
And you believe climate change is also a catalyst for this one world government?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Aircon back in 2009, and I was looking at, first of all, the science on the climate issue, and I found that it wasn't settled as was claimed, and I laid out a lot of peer-reviewed scientific papers that raised big questions about how much climate change was really taking place, was human-caused. But then I did the whole follow-the-money trick that I told you about earlier.
Yeah.
And when I followed the money, I found out there were huge vested interests clipping the ticket on this and looking to impose this world government agenda as part of it. And they saw climate change as their Trojan horse that they could wheel into every single city. And once it was there, the people would welcome it because they all want to do something about the climate or the environment. But by then, it's too late. The mechanism's been put in place.
Ian, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back after the top of the hour, and we'll take phone calls with you. I do want to talk with you about the late Father Malachi Martin, who said that the Vatican has done a deal with the devil. I want to get your take on that because it's tied into this globalism.